7 o'clock, it's a Thursday, must be time for Green Zine. If you're listening in live time here on, about April the 18th, I'm going to call it. Todd Tyson in the studio and Henry Swayze joining me from the Queen City of Vermont, and that would be Burlington in just a moment. We're going to play a piece of music inspired by the front page of the White River Valley Herald. It comes out on Thursday. You might want to check it out. But before we get into that, let's acknowledge our underwriters, the solar tracking company based in Norwich, Vermont. Solaflect is a underwriter of Green Zine. Also, Bale, building a local economy. There's a lot of information at their website. They often have live speaking and film events at their space on the green here in, on the common, as we say, in South Royalton. Find out more about their activities at balevt.org. Tom Wells and his company, Royal Trailworks, longtime supporter of Green Zine and the station in general. Daniel Leibowitz, the original treasurer of this radio station, the Upper Pass Beer Company, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, which is doing a lot of cleanup and renovations of its buildings and grounds over there in Brandon, and they expect to be putting on a full-blown festival in the summer of 2025. And last but not least, located just across the border in Tunbridge, Vermont, just turn right through the Howe-covered bridge off of 110, White River Land Collaborative. And you may want to go to their website and check them out. They're going to be having a ephemeral flower walk this coming Sunday, and I believe that is between 10 a.m. and noon. Well, for those of you who do read the Herald or live in Tunbridge and live nearby and care about recreational trails to get out in nature, once again, the Legal Trails saga is in the paper. You might want to check it out. And it reminded me of, I think this song was actually written by Steve Gillette and Cindy Mangson, who lived down in Bennington, Vermont. But here's a version of the old trail as performed by none other than Don Williams.
There's a new ridge road that cuts the mountain to the bone, slices through the woods like there ain't nobody home. You can wheel on up to Valley View, you'll never feel the climb. Oh, but I take the old trail every time. The old trail just moseys right along, moves at the speed of a sweet love song. And the wind through the trees carries her own wind chimes. Yeah, I take the old trail every time. Lately it seems things vanish by degrees. How soon we forget we made our tree houses out of trees. When we gonna realize some reasons just don't rhyme? Yeah, I take the old trail every time. The old trail, now may she never fade, the one where the deer always have the right of way. How I love watch the wintergreen along the timber line. Yeah, I take the old trail every time. People in cars let the radio do the talking, but I always find that I'm singing when I'm walking. The old trail just moseys right along, moves at the speed of a sweet love song. And the wind through the trees carries her own wind chimes. Yeah, I take the old trail every time. I take the old trail every time.
Well, I think a lot of listeners could empathize with the feelings in that classic song, The Old Trail, as performed by Don Williams here on Green Zine. And just to make a brief reference to the story that is in today's Herald, April 18th edition. And Darren Marcy actually has covered this ongoing saga for probably the last year and a half or so, and I've met him. The headline in the upper right corner is Tunbridge Talks Trails Again, Town Postpones Proposed Plans. Well, that's happened before. Basically, the gist of the discussion at a recent select board meeting about a legal trail, it's called the Orchard Legal Trail, is whether the down trees, and there have been two down trees for a couple of years, and now there are more significant down trees there, whether they could be removed by the town for safety purposes. One of the select board members has quoted that maybe someone could get hurt trying to climb over that tree. The landowner there, the plaintiffs, won't even mention their names here, but you probably know who they are because they are in the paper pretty often, are contending that they exclusively have the right to do any maintenance on the legal trail. The case has reached the Vermont Supreme Court. No date has been set. One of the attorneys for the defendant, which be the town of Tunbridge, is stating now it looks like the best bet is the case will be heard in front of the Vermont Supreme Court this summer rather than this spring. So you, if you're interested in maintaining public rights of way that have been around for maybe a couple of centuries, if not, maybe shorter, but maybe a couple of centuries, you should get involved. And there will be a follow-up on this issue at the next Tunbridge Select Board meeting, and that is on Tuesday, May the 14th. Now I will welcome my colleague, Henry. Good morning, Henry. Do you like that Old Trail song?
I do, and you know, just the nice rhythm of it and so forth made you want to just forget about all this complicated stuff and just enjoy old trails.
That's right. All the complicated stuff we're about to talk about here on Green Scene. Yeah, I got you. There's old trails. Actually, when I was doing some research on this very issue three and a half years ago and questioning a lot of other towns in our area and then looking at statewide you know, the Department of Transportation, if you're curious about old trails and designation of legal trails in Class 4, the Vermont Department of Transportation does have statistics. And I forget what the percentage of towns in the state of Vermont out of the 251, but I believe it's over half have legal trails on them. And, of course, they are used by any number of users, whether they're people on horseback or people on, on their own 2 feet or people riding a non-motorized bike, et cetera. So it is pretty interesting to see how history continues to play a role even in 2024 as far as the maintenance and protection of public rights of way.
Yeah, and trails are slower moving. They're a time when, you know, it's good for our souls to be out where everything is not rocket speed. Get down to the human scale of walking or maybe going slowly on a some kind of a conveyance on a trail, but certainly not 20 and 30 mile an hour that our street traffic gives us.
Right.
And I don't know how you put speed limits on it. I know that electric bikes, which I own one, I frequently ride it on the sidewalk, and I ride it at jogging speed. I ride it at about 6 miles an hour.
Yeah.
If I'm on a sidewalk. You know, if I had a big, long straightaway, a nicely paved sidewalk, and no one was on it, I might take it all the way up to 15. But but as soon as there's a person there, then it gets cranked right down. And that those speeds at, you know, at 15 miles an hour, you don't see birds anymore. At walking speed, you do.
Yes.
And And if you are walking and paying attention, you can stop and observe a tree bud that's opening or things like that. And you won't do that when you're moving at 10, 15 miles an hour. It's it puts you in a different zone.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Quality of life is the bottom line that we need to keep looking for. So we've last week's show we looked at the carbon footprint of what happens when you are in really densely populated neighborhoods, that it always goes up, and the speed of things slows down when you're in those dense neighborhoods. It turns into a much bigger walking component.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all helps with quality of life as well as with not destroying the planet.
Well, you know, just speaking of urban concentration of people and its carbon impact, which actually the more people you have in an urban area who might otherwise live in a suburb or something where the carbon impact would be much higher, is that a lot of downtowns, including a number of years ago, Church Street in Burlington, the main drag in Denver, Colorado, is the only thing that's allowed to roll on wheels as far as having power, is a electric bus that goes up and down the 15 blocks of downtown Denver. And people can get either on foot or on that free bus wherever they need to go, and thus, of course, keeping those vehicles, cars, out of the downtown area. So it's been a very attractive feature, these pedestrian walkways in major cities, both economically for local businesses, but also for the environment. So good to bring some good news to the equation.
Yes. So we have just before we get into bird note, we have we're looking at the utility grid, and we have Avram Pat, who is a member of the Vermont House, but previously for many years was the head of Washington Electric Co-op. To talk about kind of what would be an ideal electric grid. How would it work if we were either starting out from scratch or starting from where we are and trying to figure out how to make it work? And on that same note, Vermont 350 wants to thank the House Energy and Environment Committee for voting out a bill that they were working on. It's tucked under Senate 305, which will, once it's been finally confirmed, which it hasn't yet all the way been through all of its different places it has to go, will allow thermal energy networks. So those are mostly compact groups of buildings, and a town can decide that instead of having a furnace in each, you can tap into ground source energy, most likely in Vermont, with heat pumps that are more efficient than air sourced heat pumps, and power multiple houses, and that is now going to be allowed. It seems highly likely that that will make it through all of its hurdles. And at the same time, they also did an electric low-income ratepayer bill, which put it in the Public Service Board to figure out how to make it work so that you are protecting low-income people as all of the energy is moving towards electric, that they will not have to spend more than a certain portion of their income on electricity.
Yeah, and interesting, we've talked about this before, but a lot of the pushback about moving more and more of our energy supply to renewable energy, and particularly solar in Vermont, was that this was going to be put on the backs of low-income Vermonters who were going to have to pay more because they weren't getting at least the initial incentives that were there that have been kind of winnowed down for those who could afford to put solar up at their own home or at their own business. But this income sensitivity sort of starts to take that off the table. So I'm glad to see that there's some equity coming into the equation, yeah. Henry.
Working hard to make that happen.
Yeah.
And I think it will. And I think it's totally appropriate. I mean, the more well-off folks use the lion's share of the energy, and energy is, even electric energy is still has closely hooked to how much fossil fuel is burned or other CO2 emitting activity, burning wood, etc., with inefficient wood burning power plants rather than efficient ones like a good wood stove would be in our house. So those people who are in that even top 60% of the income bracket, not just a few very rich, those people are not bothered much by 5 or 10% or 20% change in energy costs because they have a fairly good buffer in their wallet with their income level. But for low-income people, it takes food off the table. It's definitely a crunch issue when energy costs go up. And environmentally sound energy, in some cases, is cheaper and in some cases more expensive, but energy costs are going to tend to rise anyway. And certainly if we do a lot of build-out on the grid, that will increase energy prices. And if we don't do the build-out, we may not have a grid that works. So who knows? That's one of the things we'll talk about with Avram when we have him.
Right. And
maybe we ought to move on to hummingbirds.
Yeah, we'll go to hummingbirds. And actually, we'll be playing a song about when the grid doesn't work. But that'll be after we speak with Representative Avram Pratt. I just wanted to make note of a term that I haven't seen recently, but it does pertain particularly in our area. And I think specifically in big parts of Orange County, Vermont, and that is energy burden. So this is, I don't know if Efficiency Vermont or VNRC puts this together. Jared Duvall could probably answer. He's with the Energy Action Network. And that is kind of a metric that shows the amount of income that a household has to devote to energy. And that would include heating a home, the electricity used in the home or the power used in the home, and then, of course, the transportation, which we know is a significant factor. And Orange County is right up there in like the top two or three counties as far as a high energy burden. So it does augur well to have some change there. But as Henry said, it is time for Bird Note. And Henry, you know, it's getting up towards 20 after. So if you wanted to put in call into Avram during Bird Note, and we'll bring you back up in a couple of minutes. All right.
I'll do that.
Sounds good. So we're going to check in with the ruby-throated hummingbird and might even do a poem about birds here immediately after, and then we'll talk with Henry and Avram Pratt. You're listening to Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. It's late April in the Northeast. You've just stepped out for a breath of spring air and... Hey, what was that? A tiny bird just whizzed by like a bullet. There it is over by those scarlet flowers hovering. It's a hummingbird. It must be a ruby-throated hummingbird, the only hummingbird that nests in the eastern states. No wonder it buzzed you. You're wearing a red baseball cap. Must have thought you were a really prized flower. Most ruby-throated hummingbirds spend the winter in Central America. By March, some males are already returning to the southeast, but it's well into April before they reach the northern states. female hummingbirds arrive a couple weeks later, after the males have staked out breeding territories. Males greet females with a remarkable aerial performance, flying back and forth in a perfect arc, like a pendulum suspended on an invisible wire, and accompanied by buzzing wings and cricket-like chirps. So fill up the hummingbird feeder, put on a red hat or jacket, and listen for a hummingbird coming your way.
And we're happy to bring you Bird Note each week here on Green Zine. And we're going to go into something else, and then we'll rejoin Henry and our guest today. So the Herald, which just came out today, they're helping celebrate Poem Town, specifically in the town of Vermont, which is in Orange County. And there are a number of poems here. This is the opening page of Section B. And since we were just talking about birds, I thought I would read this poem from Gina Logan, who is from Braintree. Her poem is entitled Grandmother Knew the Birds. Grandmother knew the birds by their songs, of course, by sizes, shapes, and colors, by the kind of seeds and fruits, or bugs or worms, they favored, by their nesting habits, by the patterns that their wings carved in the air. She fed them every day. The yard and garden, trees and bushes all twittered and cooed, cawed, chirped, whistled. To small me, she translated, "Hear him, that one, the cardinal? He tells us to have cheer, cheer, cheer." Of the other crested visitor, Mr. Tufted Titmouse, she recounted with a droll look, "Him, he's always searching for his good friend, Peter, Peter, Peter." Of course, there were other drabber but still cherished loves, the chickadees in their black yarmulkes, minions gathering to daven at the seed table, nuthatches on their funny upside-down quests, goldfinches, yellow as dandelions. She admitted she liked those weeds better than the peonies she tended with anxious, hovering love. And if a rose-breasted grosbeak came, I had to leave my toys or book at her quick call and hurry out to see the feathered miracle. Our God sent the birds to us for angels on this earth, saying this in a voice of such deep joy that even I, a child with only infant understanding, could apprehend and dimly share this daily offering, not food alone, nor only for the birds, but for us all, her faithful prayer. That from Gina Logan, a poet up in Braintree, Vermont. Well, let's see if we can bring Henry back online. Henry, are you there? Paging Henry. No, I guess Henry hasn't been able to make that connection yet, so I'm going to bring him back down. And there are a couple of other nature-related poems. I think I'll go into a tough choice here. You know, a noted poet who I've seen speak before is listed on here, and his name is Herb Gertz. I thought this was pretty interesting, particularly quite a span of time involved. It's called Let Me Be. Once more, I want to see the harvest moon. Once more, to shiver with delight on the immense whiteness of a winter night. Once more, I want to hear the wood thrush sing in spring. Feel the round ripened of a summer season. Did I just ask yet for another year, when 90 are complete, very near? It seems my lust for life is ravening. I freely own I cannot get enough of it. And when the reaper finally does make his way to me, I will refuse to shake his hand and tell him, let me be. You're listening to Green Zine. It's 24 minutes after 11, and we're hoping to reconnect with Henry and Avram Pratt. Henry, are you there?
Yes, we are here.
Excellent.
And Avram, welcome to Green Zine.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, welcome back, Avram.
Yes, it is back.
Had to find a quiet place at the State House. the house is on the floor right now, and when the phone started ringing here, so I had to make my way out.
Okay, well, thanks for giving us some of your precious time. Henry, go ahead, fire away.
I hope you aren't standing in a broom closet in order to have any privacy to talk on the phone.
No, I am sitting. There's a wonderful room in the State House called the Legislative Lounge. It was once upon a time in ancient history. This was where the Supreme Court met. And it's now a lounge and workspace with workstations and stuff. And at the moment, because all the legislators, I presume the senators as well, are busy in session, there is no one in here except one staff member. So it's pretty quiet.
All right. Done well. This is a daunting subject because it's so complex and has pushes and pulls. But I just think it'd be worth exploring. We're delivering our electricity to people in all different ways. Todd lives in a house that's totally off the grid. So we got one extreme there, and most people live in houses that are totally on the grid. And the grid has kind of grown higgly-piggly with add-ons and elbows and whatever done to it over the years. And I just thought we should step back and say, what should the grid look like, and how do we work our way towards a future grid that perhaps is more efficient and customer friendly and climate friendly and energy usage friendly. We tend to consume more and more and more. So with that, I'll let you wail into this, and then we can go back and pick out some individual areas maybe that are problematic now or that we should explore.
Okay, I'll start by saying, first of all, as a former utility person, I actually happened to be an event here this morning celebrating National Line Worker Appreciation Day. So actually there were some current line workers and the current manager of Washington Electric Co-op where I used to work. So I just thought I'd mention that in starting. The question about how should the grid work going forward, and yes, I'll just start by saying things have been changing in terms of the grid and how it's used, because historically and still to a considerable degree, it was moving generation usually at produced at larger, and that can be defined differently, but I'll say commercial scale generation of one kind or another. Traditionally, that was all owned by the utilities themselves, and more that became some is owned by the utilities, some is owned by businesses that are in the business of selling their generation. So it has become a bit more decentralized. It was really one way sending power out from the larger generators that were in different locations around the region. And I'll just stop just mention for people's kind of education, just so we understand that we're talking about different levels of the grid. We're talking about the high voltage transmission grid, and that is the grid usually on tall poles or towers that is sending large amounts of electricity and distributing it into regions. From there, it's sent on smaller, what's called sub-transmission, somewhat lower voltage, but it is still not the type of line that is actually bringing power to our homes and businesses on the roads we live on and whatnot. And then from there, it is step down again in terms of voltage to distribution voltage, and that's your utility that you are a customer of, a retail utility that can be a private investor owned, can be a municipal utility, can be a co-op. But the distribution utilities and their lines are what is going out every road, whether it's in town or way out in the back roads and hills of Vermont, and bringing power to the individual meters at people's homes and other locations. So that's a kind of real overview of what we're talking about. As time has gone on, and particularly with the development of renewable resources, some of which are smaller scale, or you know, home-based net metering, but producing some excess over what the customer is actually using at home, it becomes necessary for the grid at the more local level to be able to deal with that. And so that's what the grid is adapting. But it takes time. And just as an example of the problem that can be caused in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, there is I won't go into what the letters stand for, but it's called the SHEI interconnection. It's a major high-level transmission interconnection that connects with Quebec and all of that. In that area, which is the most rural part of the state, generally speaking, there are a few larger renewable energy projects. There are two wind projects, the one in Sheffield that Washington Electric Co-op takes a piece of the power of, the one that Green Mountain Power built, and the Coventry landfill methane plant that Washington Electric Co-op also built, which provides about 70% of the co-op's power, as well as some, say, commercial scale of size solar projects, and then an increase in home net metering. And it got to the point where the grid in that rural area could not take all of that. And some of the larger projects, like the landfill methane project, some of the large solar project, were being told to curtail at times, basically to put out less power than they were being capable of. And that's a big problem, because those are the most economic and most reliable and most dependable of the renewable resources. And to have them shut down because the grid can't tell everyone that's home net metering, you know, to stop doing that, the only thing they have control of is the commercial scale project. So that's the kind of problem that can occur. My understanding, because I'm not directly in this business anymore, is a lot has been done to correct some of that, but it still can be an issue. But I want to mention that as the example of why the grid at all levels needs to adapt to this. What we are getting was the cheapest and most dependable renewable sources being told to shut down in order to accommodate the most expensive what I'll call capacity factor, and I'll define that, the capacity factor, the lowest capacity factor, which is small-scale solar. The capacity factor, I'll define that again for people, is any source of generation, whatever the equipment is, has a capacity to generate a certain amount of energy. That's the maximum that it can generate. It's equivalent to the horsepower of a car engine, let's say. The capacity factor is, okay, that's what it can put out, theoretically. How much over time does it actually put out? And we know that solar obviously is not generating when it's dark. Wind generates much more of the time, but not always at full capacity, depending on the wind speeds in the area. So a wind project might have a capacity factor of, let's say, 70%, not 100%, and solar usually considerably lower than that. So those are the kind of things that have to be considered, is not just with renewable, most renewable sources, not all of them, is not just can the grid, the physical grid, take the power, but how much is it going to be varying day to day and hour to hour? That's the complication that the grid, I think, is adapting to, but it takes time. And the other issue I'll just mention is
good.
So go ahead.
You're on. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yep.
There's one other thing I want to mention, and that is storage. Because of what I just said about some of our major renewable resources, small or large, not generating all the time, the ability to store some of it when it is generating for use later, either at the utility scale or at the home scale with a battery, you know, if you have solar panels on the roof, you can have a home scale storage system in your house that will, first of all, it's backup if there's a power outage, but it will store some of the excess energy that you're not using that is being generated by the solar panels. And the same can be done at a larger scale with larger, I'm going to call them commercial scale projects.
Okay, Henry, you go first. Yeah, then I have a follow-up.
So I'm thinking that that in a best world, we should not only we don't want to curtail the generation of clean power, and that occurs when there is too much activity or too much power moving over the grid. But we also could play with our demand for power, especially electric vehicles coming along. They're not a very big percentage of our vehicles yet, but as they gain, they will. Currently, some utilities give a price break for charging at certain times a day, and I'm wondering whether the grid should be thought of as a communal piece that our own battery storage could be in some way directed by the grid, or at least our demand for electricity from hot water heaters which can be, you know, don't have to be on at this particular moment. They could be on an hour from now. And if that could all be managed for the benefit of the grid, that would keep the amount of new capitalization in the grid much lower. What are your thinkings about that?
I think so. I mean, some of that, first of all, some of that is already being done. I know different utilities have incentives if you're charging an electric vehicle at home. For most people, not all, if you get an incentive to have it charged overnight, when first of all usage overall is down, and that's the best time for a number of reasons for you to be pulling power off the grid to charge your electric vehicle. Or other, I'm going to say, from a at a residential level, high uses. If you have electric hot water, and the heat is being stored at least to some degree, to give you an incentive to allow most of the water heating to also occur in those off-peak times. And that does require, I know in the case of Washington Electric Co-op, when they were advertising this kind of a program for electric hot water, one of the conditions they said was you must be connected to the Internet, because you're giving the utility the ability to manage some of that load in terms of when things are operating and when things are not, and you're getting a financial incentive for allowing that to happen. So that is already happening. I'm not sure at every utility in the state of Vermont, but I know Green Mountain Power has various kinds of incentives, I don't know, not all of the smaller municipal utilities, and there are a number of them, have all of that yet, but it is happening, and it's designed. It's a number of benefits that can come from that. First of all, is charging when there's the lowest demand on the grid, and therefore that's the lowest cost to everybody in charging up your vehicle or boosting up the temperature in your water, in your hot water heater.
You know, I've got a question. We're going to scale down a little bit. You were talking about utility scale power up in the Northeast Kingdom, and thinking of Sheffield Wind and Lowell, and then of course the Coventry landfill. Yep. In this area, probably now 7 or 8 years ago, when there was a very lucrative incentive for developers who won the lottery. We've got a major solar project that went in over in Stratford, where the old mine site was. And then just down the road here on the Back River Road, a gentleman from Maine was able to get a project. I think he's maybe up to 2.2 megawatts just down the road. But those projects in this immediate area of sort of Windsor County, Orange County, even over into parts of Washington County, doesn't seem like a major renewable project is going to be doable. So my question is, concurrently, when incentives were there for smaller sort of community-owned solar projects in anywhere from 30 kilowatt up to 150 kilowatt, the amount of paperwork involved was pretty low. The project, as long as they got some local investors and group net metering, do you think there's a future for that? I was reading in one of the publications that some of the bills that are being considered by the State House right now would actually make it even more difficult for those projects, which are not sending as much power through, the high tension wires, as you were mentioning earlier, but that certainly create some more resilience and community aspect of kind of owning their own power if it's developed, within their town. I wonder if you could speak to that.
I mean, the committee. You know, I'm on the committee in the House that deals with that, and the bill that was passed puts a hold, not a stop, on what's called community solar. And I will point out that a community solar project physically is typically the size of a commercial project. That's part of the point of doing it that way for individuals. Who, for a variety of reasons, own a piece of the output of that plant. In some cases, because where they live is not a good site for generating it at that location. But from a physical and output point of view, those are getting up into the, I'm going to say, smaller scale commercial. Solar, and the reason there was a hold on it while this gets reevaluated is really economic, because net metering in Vermont is whether it's this kind of community project or individual putting panels on their roof, is by far and away the most expensive way of paying for renewable energy, in terms of how it affects the utility and all of its ratepayers. So the reason for putting a hold and not a stop is to reevaluate not whether we should be doing this from a physical point of view, but really about the economics and how it gets paid for. I think it will come back for some of the reasons. That's my opinion. For some of the reasons you say, because people like to be able to do that, and you know, it is a way of allowing people who would not otherwise have the ability or the location to put it up at where they live.
Just to follow up on that. So let's say a town had some funding or were getting grants to put in a small solar project that could actually take care of all of the needs of municipal buildings in that town. Right now, would this hold affect them as far as their dealings with the utility, where they would say, sorry, we can't help you out until this gets all sorted out?
I don't believe so, because that's one. I mean, what you're talking about is one customer, and maybe is you know, more than one building around town.
Mm-hmm.
It's one customer. So I'm not 100% sure of that, but to me, that's not what's been called community solar. Community solar is someone announces that they want to do this, and people, individuals, households,
right,
or small businesses then sign up to basically get a piece of it.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
And I believe that the feds have some money in that will help to pay for a project for a group like a town. Offices and so forth to do more with power.
I think so, and schools as well, and you know, any kind of public building, you know, schools especially is not just the power supply, but the I know of instances where the fact that the school is getting their power from, or some of it anyway, from a larger solar project is part of the educational program of the school, and the kids all get taken out to visit the place and talk to people who can explain what this is to them. That's a good thing, aside from the actual energy that would have to be coming from somewhere else if they weren't doing that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Henry, let's wrap it up in the next couple minutes. Yep.
Yeah. So I just have kind of one more piece in this puzzle that I think would be interesting to see if there's anything, any good thoughts on here. And that is that as we electrify everything, and I have friends that are burning enormous amounts of wasted energy, you know, or just don't turn their lights off, fly airplanes, do everything without regard to, just because economically they can do it. And so how do you create an incentive? And I know, as a member of Washington Electric Co-op, that my sense was that members paid more attention to, they felt as though they had some ownership in their electricity supply, and that they had some responsibility for thinking about what was good for the system. And I'm wondering how we build that into people's behavior. How do we change people's behavior so that they're using power thoughtfully?
Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to comment very quickly on a phrase you used at the beginning of what you just said, which is I know we are moving more and more towards electrification, but I think using the term electrify everything is actually a dangerous concept, because there are downsides to everything. I think that's a very risky thing to just say everything's going to be electric, including all sources of heat in particular. So, but I think one of the things, and you mentioned Washington Electric, before there was Efficiency Vermont, even Washington Electric Co-op and Burlington Electric Department at that time were the leaders, before other utilities were, in in energy efficiency programs. And I think that one thing to do, what we need to do, is when we're giving incentives for people to move to a renewable source of energy, that be at least somewhat conditional on making sure that and especially for heat, that the building is in fact energy efficient and uses as little energy as possible, whatever the source of the energy is. It's to me, it's always efficiency and with thermal, you know, weatherization, but there are other thermal uses of the energy as well. But efficiency first before you do anything else, and regardless of what your fuel is, even if it's propane, you know, make sure the house is as efficient as possible so you're using less of it. And then let's talk about maybe switching off of propane to something else. So that's where basically where my head is at. I do think that one way to do that is to really tie incentives to checking on the efficiency of the of the house, whether it's thermal or other uses. Are your appliances as efficient as they could be? Your refrigerator and whatever. Do you have any unusual high energy uses that might not be found in most households? Well, let's take a look at that, and you're not necessarily going to make people do things because maybe they've already done it, but it sort of, you know, should be an energy audit and say, you know, yes, this house is set up to use energy efficiently, or it could use some work.
All right. Well, I want to thank you from the studio here, Avram Pratt, for joining us, taking some time out from the legislature, and you gave us a lot of great information.
Okay. Thanks. My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Great to visit with you.
Bye.
All right, Henry, I'm just going to play a little bit of this song in case the grid does go down, and then we'll be back with some calendar items coming up here on Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio. Since the grid went down. Fortunately, the grid is up. We experienced a lot of power outages here in that most recent storm, when not only did parts of the grid go down, but phone service and internet were interrupted. So we know what it's like when things go dark, Henry. Got about 5.5 minutes left in the show. Do you have a couple of tidbits that our listeners should know about?
Yeah. So I have a couple of things. One is, when the grid goes down, you know, it forces you to stop doing all the stuff you were doing, and you get a chance to kind of veg out. And if you don't frustrate yourself with you know, trying to make the grid go back up again. I remember first moving to Vermont, having major power outage, and had a lovely time with my brother and sister-in-law all sitting around playing Mahjong by kerosene lamp.
Nice.
It's not something we would have taken nearly so much time to do if we'd had power. So if you want to think about more of this, what's happening nationally with the grid, there is a program tonight at 7 p.m., the National Fix the Grid online meeting, Extinction Rebellion, Vermont 3, or not Vermont, but 350.org, so nationally 350, are all involved in this. And there's a link to go and register for that. It's free, and it's on the links for GreenZine at the bottom right-hand corner of the main page of our station's website.
Excellent.
So there's a and I just yesterday was on a grid program for 3 hours listening to discussion about the Vermont grid. And there's the devil's in the detail, but it's and it's too complicated for most people to follow, too complicated for me to follow. But I was making an effort. And there's a bottom line to all this, and that is that sustainable power, especially solar and wind, is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper as we deploy more and more of it. But the cost of moving electricity from one place to another is getting higher. And so being hooked to the grid is going to be expensive. The power that the grid pays for is going to get cheaper.
Yeah.
And how do we keep the grid from getting expensive and still make it do its job?
That's so
kind of the grand overview.
It is. That's a good overview. Hey, a couple free things. How could we let GreenZine go by without reminding folks that this Sunday, April 21st, is Earth Day. Earth Day all around the planet, and there are some special Earth Day events being put on by various nonprofits. Here is a free film that you can attend. It's called Common Ground. It'll be at the Lowe Auditorium. That's on the campus of Dartmouth College. Laura Dern, Donald Glover, and Jason Momoa, and more advocate for the growing regenerative agriculture movement in this urgent, upbeat environmental doc. I also know that there's going to be an EV expo. I'm not going to go to this one because it's down in the vortex at the Shaw's at the West Lebanon exit. So that's exit 20, just across the border. If you want to learn a whole lot about more about EVs, there'll be a really long line at that fast charger. So don't plan to charge down there. More about EVs there. And also there is that ephemeral water flower walk that the White River Land Collaborative is putting on. That's also on Sunday, Earth Day, from 10 a.m. to noon. Green Up Day is right around the corner, and just a whole lot more. I'm sure there are activities in your area. Henry, while I have the mic, I do want to thank folks that keep GreenZine on the air every week here for more than 11 years. And they include the White River Land Collaborative, Solar Fest, First Branch Coffee Company, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Daniel Leibowitz, Royal Trail Works, Bale, and Solaflect. And as we move to our last minute, Henry, I will turn it back to you, and I hope you're enjoying this waltz by way of Sweden.
Yes, I think it's one of those Nicola Harpas.
Very good. You got it, Henry. The Nicola Harpa.
So one more regenerative food piece. There is, again, a link for a film you can watch a half hour on regenerative food in prisons, and it's reducing the recidivism of people not coming back to prison as often once they've had good food.
Wow, that's a unique combination of things. That's agricultural justice at work.
It is.
All right. All right, Henry, look forward to spending... Next week?
Next week, we will be doing artificial intelligence.
All right, you rounded up the AI expert. We'll look forward to that. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! You've been listening to WFVR-LP in South Royalton, Vermont.